I was raised to believe in the importance of a quiet time with the Lord. Replete through scriptures are references to the value of waiting for the Lord and spending time with God. On such occasions, the debris we have gathered during the hurried, busied hours, our day gets filtered out. Not unlike the silt that settles where the river widens, and we're able to see things more clearly, to feel God's nudgings more sensitively. Chuck Swindoll comments, David frequently understood the benefits of solitude. I am certain he first became acquainted with this in this discipline as he kept his father's sheep. And later, during those tumultuous years when King Saul was borderline insane and pursuing him out of jealousy, David found that his time with God, not only to be a needed refuge, but his means of survival. And when he wrote, "Wait for the Lord, be strong and let your heart take courage. Yes, wait for the Lord." David was intimately acquainted with what that meant. And when he admitted, "I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined his ear to me and heard my cry," it was not out of a context of unrealistic theory. The man was hurting. He was deeply pained. And when he tore a page from his journal and used it to compose hymn 26, "Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity, and I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. Examine me, O Lord, and try me. Test my mind and my heart." He wasn't whipping up a few emotional thoughts to wow the reader. Those were splashed from the depths of his troubled soul like the salty spray that explodes when waves crash against the rocks. Time with God? Who experienced its value more than Job? After he lost everything he owned, and in worship he wrote, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And Job's quiet trust did not wear thin. The man continued to commune with God. Remember his confession? And what makes it even more remarkable is that he stated it while surrounded by those who accused him. "But he knows the way I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot has held fast to his path. I have kept his way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the command of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food." That's it. That's exactly what occurs when we get alone, remove ourselves deliberately from the fast track, keep our appointment with him who made us. His words take on greater meaning than a good meal. And what great thoughts he has for us. What insights. What comfort, what reassurance. And unexpectedly through you and I may even have met in solitude with God morning after morning. Suddenly there comes a morning with that is just special, like none other, when he reveals his plan to us and we're blown away. It happened to Moses. Alone with his father-in-law, Jethro's flock of woolies, on the backside of the desert, perhaps after howling winds of the night had settled and the searing sun of the Sinai had come out. God spoke to him through the awesome midst of a bush that was strangely ablaze. Now, what had God said? What was it that the 80-year-old over-the-hills shepherd heard? In effect, lead the Exodus. The night before, who would have ever guessed that an otherwise ordinary dawn would find the old man reeling in disbelief, least of all Moses? F.B. Meyer wrote this with eloquence. There are days in all of our lives that come unannounced, unheralded. No angel faces look out of heaven. No angel voices put us on our guard. But as we look back on them in later years, we realize that they were turning points in our existence. Perhaps we longingly look back on the eventual routine of life that lies beyond them. But the angel with drawn sword forbids our return and compels us to move forward. So it was with Moses. Understand these phenomenal moments are the exception, not the rule, because if God spoke to us like from a burning bush each day, it'd just be common like traffic lights and ringing phones. Fact is, never again in all of time has the voice of God been heard from a bush that refused to be consumed by flames. You see, God is into original works, not complicated recordings and duplicated again and again. Never doubt, he still longs to speak to waiting hearts, to have a relationship with us, hearts that are quiet before him. And as David wrote his maskil, instructive and contemplative psalms, therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they will not reach him. You are my hiding place. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with songs of deliverance. I will instruct you and teach you in my way where you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. So let me urge you just to remain faithful in quiet times with God, because he will certainly be faithful to provide the answers that you need as you need them. Using the Lord's Prayer as a floor plan for the great house of God, Max Lucado introduces us to a God who desires his children to draw close to him, indeed to live with him. And so today we'll look at the foundation where trust begins. The most essential word as we study in the Lord's Prayer is also the shortest. Be careful you don't miss it. A lot of people do. The word's so brief, it'll sneak right past you if you aren't careful. Without it, the great house of God cannot stand. Remove it and the house tumbles to the ground. What's the word? I'll give you a hint. You just heard it. It is. Diana and I enjoyed watching a classic film last week, God Is Not Dead. God is. Not God was. Not God will be. Not God could be or should be, but God is. He's the God of the present tense, and he is the foundation of our house. As you know, I draw a great deal from Max Lucado. And when he was writing about the mortar of our faith, he was on an airplane, a late airplane. an airplane different from the one he was originally assigned to. Quote, my first flight was canceled due to a mechanical difficulty. A few dozen passengers, not so happy, campers, and I were transferred to another plane. And as we checked in for the new flight, I heard many of my fellow passengers ask the attendant, is this plane okay? Is this 747 ready to go? We were full of questions about the plane's ability to fly, but the ticket agent had no questions about our ability to do the same. Not once were we asked you, how about you? Can you fly? Can you flap your arms and get airborne? Of course, that's a bizarre question. My ability to fly is not important. My strength is immaterial. I'm counting on the plane to get me home. Need I make a connection? Your achievements, however noble they may be, are not important. Your credentials, as starry as they may be, are not of any concern. God is the foundation of this house, and the key question of life is not how strong am I, but how strong is God? Focus on His strength, not yours. Occupy yourself with the nature of God, not the size of your biceps. And that's what Moses did, or at least that's what God told Moses to do. Do you remember that conversation at the burning bush? The tone was set in the very first sentence. Take off your sandals because you are standing on holy ground. And with those 11 words, Moses is enrolled in a class on God. Immediately, the roles are defined. God is holy. Approaching Him on even a quarter inch of leather is too pompous. And as we read further, we discover that no time is spent convincing Moses what Moses can do, but much time is spent explaining to Moses what God can do. You and I tend to do the opposite. If we were recruiting Moses, we could explain to him how ideally suited he is to return to Egypt. Who better understands the culture than a former prince? And then we would remind Moses how perfect he was for wilderness travel. Who knows the desert better than a shepherd? And we'd spend time reviewing with Moses his resume and strength. Come on, Moses, you can do it. Give it a try. But God doesn't. The strength of Moses is never considered. There's no pep talk given, no pats on the back are offered. Not one word is spoken to recruit Moses, but many words are used to reveal God's strength. The strength of Moses is not the issue. The strength of God is. And likewise, your strength, my strength, is not the issue. The strength of God is. You aren't the force behind the plane or the mortar in the foundation. God is. And I know you know that in your head, but do you know that in your heart? Would you like to? Let me show you some of the boulders that support this mighty house. Let me buttress your confidence in God by sharing with you some of His names. And what's in a name? Well, understanding the names of God is no quick study. After all, there are more than 80 names for God in the Old Testament alone. But if you want a place to begin, let me entice you with a few of the compound words, names given to God by some of the heroes of the faith. Each one of them reveals a different rock of God's character. And for this, we look to Nathan Stone. In a work published by Moody Press, he defines for us the names of God And as he puts it, the more God's people came to know him, the more names they gave him. Initially, God was known as Elohim. In the beginning, God, Elohim, created. The Hebrew word Elohim carries with it the meaning strong one or creator, and appears 31 times in the first chapter of Genesis, where we see his creative power. And as God revealed himself to his children, they saw him as a more than a mighty force. They saw him as a loving father who met them on every crossroad of their lives. Jacob, for example, he came to see God as Jehovah Ra, a caring shepherd. Like a shepherd, Jacob told his family, "God has led me all my life." And this phrase was surely a compliment to God, for Jacob was a less than cooperative sheep. Twice he tricked his brother. At least once he succored his blind father. He outcrossed his double-crossing father-in-law by conning him out of his livestock. And then when the fellow wasn't looking, he made like a colt out of Baltimore in the middle of the night, sneaking off with anything that wasn't nailed down. Jacob was never a candidate for the Most Well-Behaved Sheep Award, but God never forgot him. He gave him food in his famine, forgiveness in his failure, and faith in his final years. And ask Jacob to describe God in a single word, it would be Jehovah Ra, the caring shepherd. Abraham has a different name for God, Jehovah Jireh, the Lord who provides. It's ironic that Abraham would call God provider, since Abraham was already well provided for. He lived in a split-level tent with a four-camel garage. Life was good in Ur. But life will be better in Canaan, he told his family, and so off they went. And when they asked, "Where will we live?" Abraham answered, "God will provide." And God did. And when they got caught in an Egyptian scandal, the people wondered, "How will we get out?" And Abraham assured them, "God will provide." And he did. And when they split up the land and nephew Lot took the grasslands and left Uncle Abraham with the rocks, the people wondered, "How will we survive?" And Abraham gave them an answer, "God will provide." And he did. And when Abraham and Sarah stood next to the empty crib and she wondered how he'd ever be the father of thousands, he put his arm around her, whispering, "God will provide." And God did. And Abraham bounced his firstborn on his 100-year-old bony knees. Abraham learned that God provides. But even Abraham must have shook his head when God asked him to sacrifice his son on Mount Moriah. And up to the mountain they went. "Where is the lamb we will burn as a sacrifice?" the son said. One wonders how the answer made it past the great lump in Abraham's throat. "God will give us a lamb for the sacrifice, my son. Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide." And as Abraham tied up his son and placed him on the altar and raised the knife, and the angel stayed his hand, Abraham had proven his faith. He heard a rustling in the thicket and saw a ram caught by its horns in the bush, and he offered it as a sacrifice and gave the mountain a name, Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide. And then there was Gideon. The Lord came to Gideon and told him he was to lead his people in victory over the Amalekites, the Midianites. Well, that's kind of like God telling a housewife to stand up to her abusive husband, or a high school student to take on the drug peddlers. But then God reminds us that he knows we can't, but he can. And to prove it, he gives us a wonderful gift. He brings the spirit of peace, like peace before a storm, peace beyond logic, or as Paul described it, peace that passes understanding. He gave it to David after he showed him Goliath. He gave it to Saul after he showed him the gospel. He gave it to Jesus as he showed him the grave and the cross. And he gave it to Gideon. So Gideon in turn gave the name to God, and he built an altar and named it Jehovah Shalom. The Lord is peace. At least a couple of boulders beneath the house knew the chisel of Moses. And once he carved the name Jehovah Rophi. And you'll find the English translation in Exodus 15, 26. I am the Lord who heals you. Here's the setting. Over 1 million Israelites had been liberated from captivity. Fellow Moses, they followed him into the desert. They walked 3 days through the land void of shade and streams and houses and greenery. Their only neighbors were the sun and the serpents. And they finally came upon a lake, but the water was brackish and bitter, dangerous. Max says, I'm sure it wasn't funny at the time, but you've got to chuckle about what happens next. So Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. Moses is begging for water, and God shows him some wood. Let's pause and total the damage. 3 days in the desert sun. Hopes raised at the sight of a lake. Hopes dashed at the taste of the water. Moses, who was cotton-mouthed and parched-lipped, asks for relief, and God shows him a tree. Well, Moses responds by throwing the tree into the lake. Maybe he did it out of aggravation. How? Here's what I think of this tree stuff. Or maybe he did it out of inspiration. You're in charge, God. Whatever the reason, the water is purified. The Israelites' thirst is satisfied. And God is glorified. In this case, God himself reveals his name. In Exodus 15, 26, I am the Lord who heals you. The operative word here is I. God's the one who heals. He may use a branch of medicine or a branch of a hospital or a branch of a live oak tree, but he is the one who takes the poison out of the system. He is Jehovah Rophi. He's also Jehovah Nisi, the Lord my banner. And in the heat of the battle, soldiers feared getting separated from their army. And for that reason, the banner was carried into the conflict. And if a fighter found himself alone, the raised flag would signal where there was safety. And when the Amalekites, who were the big bad guys, attacked the Israelites, who were the little good guys, Moses went up on the mountain and prayed, and as long as his hands were up, the Israelites prevailed. But when his hands went down, the Amalekites won. So Moses was no dummy. He kept his hands up, needed help doing so, but the Israelites won, the Amalekites ran, and Moses built an altar for God, and then he chiseled a new name on the stone, Jehovah Nissi. The Lord is my banner. Those are just a few of the names of God that describe his character. Max suggests that we study them. Any given day, you may need each one of them. So let me show you what I mean. When you are confused about the future, you go to your Jehovah Ra, your caring shepherd. When you're anxious about provision, you talk to Jehovah Jireh, the God who provides. Are your challenges great, or you seek the help of Jehovah Shalom? The Lord is peace. Is your body sick? Are your emotions weak? Jehovah Rophi, the Lord who heals you, will see you now. Do you feel like a soldier stranded behind enemy lines? You can take refuge in Jehovah Nissi, the Lord, my banner. Meditating on the names of God reminds you of his character. So take the names, just bury them in your heart. God is. God is the shepherd who guides. God is the Lord who provides. The voice who brings peace in the storm. The physician who heals the sick. The banner that guides the soldier. And most of all, he is. Selah.